Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Chris Jackson. And Fred and I were just seeing if we could come up with a list of sort of the typical reliability strategies you can choose from when you're trying to create a reliable thing. And yeah, we've come up with a couple of ideas, and we thought we'd actually see if we could categorize them and come up with a list that might be, you know, helpful beyond this conversation.
Well, you know, the first one that comes to mind, Chris, is occasionally I get a client and or a potential client that wants to talk about their reliability approach and their program and their strategy. And my favorite one by far was, we don't need no stinking consultant to tell us what to do. I just hire the best engineers possible and we create products. And he says, well, how's the reliability working? And he goes, well, customers don't know how to use our product. They just abuse it. It's not our fault. It's, you know, it's always customer abuse. That's our biggest issue. We need better customers. It's like, well, that's a great strategy. Blame your customers.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't, let's not count that one. That's not a viable strategy, but that's the baseline, the low end.
Absolutely. Yeah. Reliability engineering isn't telling anyone how to be a better hydraulic engineer or a circuit designer. It's actually using their knowledge to prevent failures from occurring in the hands of customers. So anyway, yep, take your point. I'll scratch that one out from my list.
So that's my least favorite approach. It's one is because they don't need what we do or think they need what they do, but so I finally asked the guy, he says, why did you call me? He says, well, we have this big field failure rate in the field, and we were hoping a reliability engineer can take the blame for it. He didn't phrase it that way, but it was the way it came across.
Yeah, okay. Well, if we're going to open up with strategies that don't work, then I'll go another one as well. It's called the military approach, where, you know, militaries, you have a bunch of officers who are seemingly competent at the field of, or the art of war, but when it comes to overseeing a contractor design and build a reliable tank or military vehicle or weapon, it just all those principles disappear, and they just revert to drill sergeant lawyers with big sticks when things don't go their way, when the 65th millionth requirement in a contract doesn't come off the way they wanted it to come off.
That's right. Yeah. If I stand up and yell loud enough, it'll get better.
And they because they don't know what they're doing, they just focus on having these exhaustive meetings and conferences where they go through Formica outputs and don't really assess whether the Formica inputs were good. I don't know how to characterize that, but that's just it's increasingly prevalent in today's militaries, where they just replace thinking with paper and documents and clauses.
I got a few stories like that too, and and there's others that but on the complete opposite end of this, it's one of the strategies is where it's just baked into the organization, right? It's every and you've heard me tell the story of this organization that their reliability professional, Ma Bell, had left a couple of years prior, but she had basically taught electrical engineers, mechanical engineers, system engineers, marketing, finance, the quality group. They had a couple of engineers in the quality team. Everybody else, how to do reliability, how to think about reliability, how to incorporate it into the business strategy. There wasn't a separate reliability plan. There was a product development plan. And reliability and was just a natural part of the evolution of design and a product. So I sat down with an electrical engineer in this team, and I said, so, you know, what's the goal? Well, the goal's this, and I get it from these guys. We talk about it, and here's how I approach it. And it was a little bit of as understanding what the risks were, and then if I needed some expertise, I'd go find somebody that could run a test for me. I knew, and I said, so how do you work with your vendors? And she was like, she could have been, you know, a 30-year experienced high performing reliability professional, And she says, oh, we go after this. And we, if they give me answers, like, we just give you a fit rate. Well, fit rate's not useful for me. I need this kind of information. And I was just blown away about how prevalent the reliability thinking was in that organization. Right. And that it wasn't like they said, oh, we have a reliability strategy. We just make reliable products. We consider reliability and performance and cost and everything else, but we have all the tools and the capability to think about it naturally. And that is, it's beyond strategy. It was just their culture.
The way you characterize that organization, I've seen a couple of these ones too, where everyone seems to have the reliability mindset, where they know what's valuable for the organization and it's up to them to make good decisions in a way that's encouraged culturally. Is that about right?
Yeah. It's just where it's there's not a separate reliability plan, right? And there's a whole spectrum from completely ignore it to it's built into the culture.
Right.
But it's the best strategy is that it's just part of how you do business. It's senior managers all the way through the organization walk and talk the same process. And it wasn't separate from the business objectives or separate from the list of requirements. It was just part of it, and so it's not you can't point to it and say that's our strategy. This is just the way we do business, and that was a joy to experience.
So why were you there then if they didn't need any help?
I was trying to figure out what they did right because they were so good at it, It was part of when I was at Hewlett Packard, it was part of doing a reliability assessment of all the different organizations, all the different teams. And they were one of three that had their act together out of 50. There was only a couple that really got it, had an shining example of what they did really well. So I ended up being their best cheerleader, promoter, and exulting how well they were doing. And they had the numbers to prove it. They had almost no field failures.
It's always handy.
Yeah.
The ball don't lie, as they say.
That's right. Exactly. So we kind of, that's a bracket for us, from worthless to whatever. But now two approaches that I often hear, and Kirk is one that advocates the just break it. Build a prototype, break it, fix it. Build, test, fix. And using HALT, in that HALT strategy as a strategy to get in the technical details. If I'm building a product, I need to understand how it fails. And then once I know how it fails, then I can fix it. And I agree with that strategy. Many engineers respond to information about how it fails. If you just say, make it better, they're like, make what better? If you say, this flange broke because it had too much weight in a normal application, well, then they know how to fix that, right? But that's one strategy. The other one is you're never going to get a prototype to go break. And if you do get one, you can only look at it from afar and admire its shiny lines, right? You're not allowed to break it. It's way too expensive. It's too dangerous. It's this, that, or the other thing. You just build, test, fix isn't going to work. And so then it's simulations and modeling and coupon testing, material science approach. It's the physics of failure type approach. More analytics, right? And that has a whole spectrum of how that could be applied. But I've seen it both ways, being very successful and also just absolutely horrible. If you do HALT testing and get a list of 10 things that go fix and then completely ignore it because, well, of course it broke. You overstressed it. It can go, but I've seen both types of approaches depending on the nature of the technology being developed work very, very well. So those are two strategies I see oftentimes.
I think it's worth mentioning too. I mean, on plenty of podcasts, including ones I've been on, we've said that build, test, fix is problematic in terms of why do you wait that long to get to a prototype before you think about how it could fail? And I suppose I don't think you're challenging the important role of preventing failures before you build your prototype. But things like a FMEA are always useful to try and work out how you prevent weak points being designed into your system from the start.
I totally agree. There's engineering judgment, there's experience, there's derating guidelines, stress strength calculations, risk assessment. All of those pieces fit into a build, test, fix strategy. But if we really don't know much about this new Hi-Zoots polymer that we're trying to use, mm-hmm. let's get some and go figure out how it fails. Right? It's rather than wait until you got a full up product, you can start. I mean, even electronics. The first round of build, test, fix is on the schematic. It's in the in the program, right? In CAD program. Hey, this just doesn't fit. It's going to weigh too much, or I'm not getting the right current here in the circuit analysis. That's a form of build, test, fix. And then you make breadboards. You mock up circuits on your desk and go test it or evaluate or play with it. I think it's not just in the reliability lab of a halt chamber. It starts with that early design concepts and early analysis. If it's with the mindset of, well, how could this not work? Mm-hmm. And build it out through. So I push back a little bit on that. I think all of those other pieces fit, but it's... and it breaks down if that's your only strategy, is we're going to wait until we have a finished prototype and then we're going to go figure it out. And then you're way too late.
I suppose that's the main point. I think we talk to Carl a lot, Carl Carlson, when it comes mm-hmm. to familiars, and he'll often use the sort of compare familiars to the build, test, fix approach, which is in the context he's talking about, he's saying using build, test, fix to talk about it's not something where that's the only strategy you have. You don't start thinking about failure until you have your first prototype. But in what we're talking about here is you're either building it in your mind and then building it as a prototype before you learn how to work out how it fails. And I suppose in a way, a familiar is building the product in your mind, collective mm-hmm. minds, to work out how it's going to fail. Maybe that's a good way of describing it.
Yeah, it's a prioritization tool, but you had to think through of all these different stresses and all the way it's used and all these different functions and how could they not work. And it can become more or less sophisticated, but that's a good way. It's an exercise. I call it an organized brainstorm is mm-hmm. my approach to it. But that's one strategy. The other strategy is completely analytic, right? You know how I feel about PhDs. No present company accepted you could go off and research this thing for 16 years and have a beautiful model at the end of the day, but you're out of business. So I think that can be done to an extreme and not useful, or vice versa is, somebody wrote a paper on this polymer that's sort of like what we're using, but it was in a lab and we're using it in outer space. So it'll work just fine. No worries. But we have this paper we can cite. You're like, no. That's not going to work. Let's think about that a little more, guys.
I've delivered plenty of lessons and talks and webinars on the hazard rate and failure rate and sort of what that means for bathtub curves. And the number of people to this day who say that's wrong because what you're talking about isn't one of the null and heap failure rates that were uncovered in that study that many years ago. And for those Nolan and Heap identified a bunch of, I suppose, typical hazard rate or bathtub curves for aircraft components. And for some reason, that seems to be
universal.
Yeah, it was.
You know, and so many people cite that as a shortcut to not having to look at their own data. Our data is not good. So we're going to use somebody, another industry on a 50-year-old, 40-year-old technology. Completely different maintenance strategy, different environment.
Oh man. Yeah.
You know, and it's always like that. Like, no. Yeah. No, that's a whole nother strategy of stick your head in a research report that supports your own conclusions and go with that. Yeah.
Right. So so far we talked about baking in reliability where everyone has a reliability mindset. You know what? I'm going to group the second thing we spoke about, which was build, test, fix, to include building in your mind, building in a computer, or building a prototype, which you then test and fix at all stages of design process. Mm-hmm. That's, I suppose, it's called hunting failure from day
yeah,
one.
Yeah, that's a good term for it. Yeah, is you're looking for, you're not afraid of failures. You're going to go find them at every stage and then deal with them.
Yeah. So the failure hunter.
That's a good idea. We have we have to come up with an avatar for that. Yeah.
Yeah.
We'd sell t-shirts.
That's not a bad idea. The failure hunter. And again, you can start hunting failures when you're building it in your mind, which you have to do, because if you're coming up with a concept of something, by definition, you're thinking about how the bolts tie pieces together before you even think about creating a CAD drawing of the individual parts. That's what engineers do. So there's no reason why you can't build it in your mind and work out how it's going to fail, which is what for me is try to do, then building in the computer once you've found those, you know, likely failure mechanisms, and you can do finite element analysis and finite element modeling before, without having to even build the first prototype. So when you do build the first prototype and test it to find your failures, you're actually testing an already robust product, and you're just making it more robust when compared to your competitors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So what about the other approach, which I've heard you mention over the years, where organizations build something, they don't think too much about reliability from a scientific perspective from the start, but they over-engineer it deliberately. They put in tons of margin because they want to focus on getting a prototype that can work, which they can do stuff with, and then they gradually remove the margins as they create, as this thing goes through its maturation.
You know, where I've run into that strategy, and it was, they kind of backed into it from a reliability point of view. It was more driven by time to market.
Right.
We don't have time to think this all the way through. And if we have a failure, it delays the launch. So the engineers get the sense of just belt and suspenders. We put everything on this thing. And we know that the next design cycle, another team is going to take a look at this and cost reduce it, right? Usually in a consumer market is where I see this approach, where they just way overdo it. Now, the other parallel is in civil engineering, right? If I'm doing the first concrete bridge, I put in twice as much rebar. I put in, you know, four times as much concrete. I do all this stuff. I way over engineer it because I don't have time to test this materials for its performance in the unknown use environment it's going to see over the next 30 years. Mm-hmm. So I'm just going to make it 10 times stronger than we think it needs to be. And then other iterations of that design look for ways to cost reduce it and strip out some of the weight and some of the materials and so on. And then they have more time to see how it responds and measure it. And eventually it leads to just classic failures of structural engineering because they go too far. But I think that approach is usually driven by other business constraints. I just don't have time. So I'm going to get the best possible components and vendors and put as much margin in as I can, because the cost is not as important as the time to market.
Right. Whereas reliability engineering can actually be very useful to prevent over-engineering. If you understand what the weak points are, what the likely failure mechanisms are, you only have to design something which deals with those ways that failure can occur, and not every possible way failure can occur. So, well, that is one approach to designing a reliable product. Reliability.
Make it very, very, yeah, yeah. You're exactly right. Start very, very robust, and then back up from that. It you got to be careful though. I think, Phil Crosby would argue that you can't be reliable enough, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's, even when you make a very reliable product, if you get field failures, which you will, you haven't covered it yet. There's always room for improvement, and it has benefits. I find the argument of we over-engineered it has more weight when it's a cost or a weight, physical weight, like for an aircraft component or those kind of constraints. It's not that it's too reliable. I don't know. Do you have any products that were just too reliable and we had to reduce its reliability?
I wouldn't say too reliable, but I do think that things like fuel efficiency, not just for the air, air travel. Fuel efficiency for ground travel and weight is an increasingly important concern. So you might not make something too reliable per se, but by making it that reliable, it's become heavier than it could. Yeah, which is, and consumers have perspectives on what should be heavy and what shouldn't be heavy. So there is a penalty for making things too heavy as a rule.
Right. That's not reliability. It's a trade-off, right? I think the strategy you're saying is it's a balance, is finding the right balance between, say, weight and the reliability performance. Because if you strip out enough of the weight that it falls apart on contact, it's not reliable anymore, right?
Mm-hmm. But it's maybe a better term is over-engineered. I mean, over-engineering typically carries a weight penalty in a raw material cost penalty as well. Right. You wouldn't classify that as too reliable. Far from it. You'd actually, if you're over-engineered, typically you're fixing failure mechanisms that aren't relevant. That's
That's where I think there's that fifth piece of the reliability definition that's missing, is that customers always want more. They want it more functions. They want more duration. They want lower probability of failure and so on, right? They want to use it in a different environment. So what we design, like the phones, right? A cell phone, even though it's a technical marvel compared to 10 years ago, we still don't want the screen to break. We still want to be able to dunk it in water and it'll still work. We still want it to have connections anywhere in the world, independent of whether there's a cell tower nearby. We still want it to, we want more out of it all the time. And we are treating it more harshly than we ever did in the past. And so I think that notion of it's, there's a penalty there. I think that the level of reliability performance, like, my phone had better last 3 years. It's expensive, and it has the functionability that I need and use every day. And now it's become critical to my operation that the phone works. And so, whereas 10 years ago it was fun to have, and I rented a phone when my first child was, my wife was working and pregnant, and I didn't want to get in touch, stay in touch. So it was a luxury item at that point. Now it's critical. So I think the ratcheting of reliability expectations continues for just about every product line. And so the strategy of building a bit, stripping out weight or cost or those kinds of features of it, has to be guarded against the reliability expectation going forward.
But you can only gouge out those costs and weight if you know that gouging out those things aren't going to cause failure, which is
right. I think problem. Yeah, I totally agree, and that's where the dilemma comes. Is people will say, "Well, it's a great product. We're not having all that many failures in the field. Let's cost reduce it." And then, how come we have all these failures?
I think that could be a separate issue in that you don't have the reliability engineering expertise or effort to actually work out, hey, what are the things we need to protect? What are those vital few, those things we keep saying? Yep. We can gouge out stuff because we're not seeing field failures. Okay, but what are the things we need to protect? And that's a whole new podcast, but I take your point. Time to market is huge. There is the costs of additional material, and in some cases weight, are trivial compared to the lost market share if you don't launch at a certain time. So I get that. And especially if there are engineers who know there'll be rounds of cost reduction coming later on, that's almost a scenario that can be set up to work, but you can see how it could easily get perverted as well.
There's another strategy that I'm not sure if it fits into one of the two or three that we've talked about so far. And that's just we're going to build it to standard. We're going to kind of take the quality approach of, here's a set of requirements. We're going to meet those requirements. And some of those requirements are regulatory, which in my opinion, rarely make any sense. and or contradictory from different jurisdictions, or we're making a toy. So we get the toy standards, and there's a standard for choking hazard. So we make sure that we meet that requirement. And there's a drop test requirement for this handheld product that the French have made, and we're going to use that. And it says drop your product 20 times on random drops, and ergo, it's good. And I don't know why that's such a prevalent strategy of we're just going to do the standard. We meet the letter of the standard, and therefore it must be good, must be reliable.
Well, it's because, sorry, I won't say it's because, that sounds fairly, I don't want to pretend that this is the only answer, but I think a good part of it deals with the fact that human beings, and especially engineers, like numbers, they like declarations, they like saying something is safe or not safe, they like saying something is reliable or not reliable. We like, when it comes to testing, we need to have these quantitative things to do our testing against.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where standards and requirements are great for people who have to have a number that summarizes achievement or summarizes performance, whereas what we're talking about first up was a reliability mindset where we're just striving to use every resource that we have as efficiently as possible to create something reliable, and know that if we do this more efficiently than our competitors, we're going to have a more reliable product and a better product. Again, let's go back to the military example where they don't have the expertise to build their own stuff, so they outsource it, but then write these contracts, which means that they need to be experts in what they're demanding, but when they're not. So it just gets to this very legalistic, this is what we want, here's a number, off you go. I think some elements of those sorts of customers recognize that when they're trying to use performance-based logistics and performance-based contracting and trying to motivate behaviors versus metrics. But it's a very comforting feeling for an engineer to have a number versus, or maybe a manager to be able to assess their own team's work versus look at the human beings involved and motivate them to be those reliability hunters we're talking about.
Yeah. Well, I think you hit on it. It provides some certainty. If I open up the standard, it says test 7 samples from 3 different batches for 200 hours under these conditions. I can plan for that. There's no surprises until you have failures that are completely unrelated to anything to deal with that test. And then wonder why your test didn't catch it. The danger is that it precludes thinking.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, you get hard numbers and durations and test conditions and everything else, and and the marketing guys love it because we can put these, 16-digit standards numbers and names on our data sheet and, check, 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 pass, pass, pass. Everything's great. I think that strategy is lazy.
Yep.
Is the way I would think about it, but call that one the lazy hunter, the couch potato strategy. I don't know.
Hunters else. And the gatherers? I don't know. The gatherers seem more passive to me, but.
Well, that is another strategy, is you ship it and pay close attention to the field failures from your customers and fix them as you go. And you gather failures from your customers. Let them do the testing for you. That's the strategy.
Customers become your test engineers.
That's right. That's right. And the ones that really care about. No. I've seen people get really, really good at it, right? Where they have a streamlined process to fix problems that are first found. And so all the early issues get resoundingly rectified. And it actually was a strategy for an organization that made servers, and they shipped. It was sort of like an extended beta program.
Yeah.
So the very early customers had design engineers come with the shipment, and they watched the installation. They hung out for a week to make sure everything was working well. Anything that failed, they jumped right on and got it changed. So the next shipment. So it was very low volume, very expensive product. And they were able to effectively reduce their overall fleet failure rate for the year dramatically by doing that. And they got past that marketing pushback of, well, you can't admit that we're going to have failures and send engineers to do failure analysis with the shipment. The customers for that particular product welcomed, because they got the product early than otherwise, and they got stuff fixed. The warranty was these four guys standing there, yeah, you know, fixing things kind of thing.
That's a very powerful commitment, though. And
it was, yeah.
Would respect that.
Yeah. And it's a unique market, right? Mm-hmm. It's, you're not going to, I would not appreciate it if I walked down to the Toyota dealership and they sent three technicians with me in a truck behind me with spare parts. That would not be comforting. There's a couple strategies for you.
I know we've been talking about this for 30 minutes, and I think we need to come back to it because we haven't even started some of the other stuff, like allocating goals and all sorts of other things and systems engineering considerations, which are very prevalent these days. So, so far we talked about, you know, baking in reliability, having a reliability mindset. The other approach, second approach, was sort of the failure hunter, where you build, test, and fix it first thing in your mind, then on a computer, then in a prototype. But at every stage of design, you are trying to find out how this thing will fail and do something about it.
Right.
The next one was the time to market approach. The build the over engineer have tons of margin, where time to market is so much more important than material cost or other things like weight. The fourth one, I don't know if it's, we can classify this as a strategy in its own right, but because standards and requirements, they are numbers, but how do you go about achieving them, even if you're not that serious about it? But I understand that outsourcing the thinking of what customers want is an approach that a lot of organizations do. Mm-hmm. And the fifth one we talked about is where the customers become the test engineers, and that's okay in some cases, if it's a low volume, very expensive products like your servers, where there's a customer will appreciate getting it early, and they do appreciate having four guys on site to oversee all the issues. That's commitment. That's customer service. But like you pointed out, don't want it with your Toyota. You certainly don't want to have an Apple genius come home with your Apple iPhone just in case something goes wrong.
They eat too much. We have to feed them. And they have to stay outside too, because social distancing.
wouldn't be able to talk about Google or every Android device that someone has to be left at the front door as you come into the house. And it'd just be a nightmare.
That's right. It'd be a nightmare, yeah. No, we'd have fun though. I'd pick their brain and learn a whole lot. if you're standing here, can you answer this question? How do I get this strange font to show up on my screen here for just this letter?
How do I program my coffee maker?
There is that. All right. Well, cool. So those, I think we, like you said, Chris, we just scratching the surface on the ways or strategies for creating a reliable product. So if you're listening to this and we haven't touched on the way you as a listener in your organization, what's your strategy, let us know. Head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. You can also find Chris and I on LinkedIn or on our about pages on Ascendo, and plenty of ways you can get in touch with us. As you know, we love getting questions or comments and feedback, and it fuels a lot of the episodes that are on our show. So let us know what you guys do, or if you heard your favorite approach, you know, let us know how it's going for you. And so with that, Chris, let's make a note to circle back to this one and pick up a few more topics here. Strategies.
Good chat.
Right, cool. Good. Yeah. Talk to you later.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.